Good morning, everyone, and welcome back. Quite a long hiatus. We left off right in the middle of a very important topic in the last shiur. The question that we were discussing was, how does the Rambam relate to someone who makes a theological error, specifically an error concerning one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah, based off of faulty reasoning? For example, someone who reads the Psukim of the Torah literally and concludes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a body, Chas V'Shalom. How does the Rambam deal with such a person? We started off by examining his statement at the end of the Hakdama to Perek HaChelek, where the Rambam writes, anyone who does not believe in any one of these 13 principles is not part of Klal Yisrael. It's a mitzvah to hate them, and they have no chelek in Olam Haba. At first glance, that sounds like, under all circumstances, anyone who doesn't believe in any one of these 13 principles is automatically excluded from both Olam Haba and the Jewish people. In Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam also more or less presents these Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah and Paragimel, and the Ravid says, concerning corporeality, why is it that the Rambam has deemed a person who denies God's corporeality a heretic? After all, there are many great people who have made this mistake based off of their understanding of the Torah and especially Midrashei Chazal, which imply that God does in fact have a body. So the question is, what would Rambam say? How would he respond to the Ravid's critique? The first approach, which we considered last week, the first of four, we did two last year, and we'll do two more today, is famously known as Reb Chaim's approach, Nebuchadnezzar Apikaris is Achatana Apikaris. And Reb Chaim basically claims that it's true, Nebuchadnezzar Apikaris, it's not really his fault. He was misled by the Psukim or by Chazal. Nevertheless, he is also an Apikores. Why is it that someone would be deemed an Apikores if, after all, it's not their fault? The answer is that this is not meant as a punishment. If it were the case that it was a punishment, so indeed we would say something like, Onus Rachmana Patre, it's not his fault, and therefore we don't hold him responsible. However, the logic for Reb Chaim presumably is that the loss of Olam Haba is a natural consequence of his faulty beliefs. We examined the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah and specifically his understanding of what the soul is, what the nefesh is. And the nefesh, the Rambam writes seemingly in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah as well as in Hilchos Tshuva, where he discusses Olam Haba, the Rambam writes that Olam Haba, or eternality, is achieved because the nefesh is capable or has understood certain truths while on this world. Specifically, when the nefesh is able to understand things, that things exist that are not physical, and specifically a correct conception of God, so then eternality becomes possible and Olam Haba is plausible. If a person does not have a correct conception of God, so then by definition Olam Haba is impossible. Not, again, because it's a punishment. After all, it's not his fault. But because the nature of the neshama is such and the nature of Olam Haba is such that with an incorrect belief, eternality and Olam Haba are by definition impossible. This first approach to the Rambam we saw was taken by the Abarbanel, among others. One of the objections that could be raised against the first approach is the Rambam's principle of Tinok Shenishba. The principle of Tinok Shenishba says that while first generation Karaites are full-fledged heretics, because, among other things, they deny one of the Ikari Emunah, they deny the Torah Shebal Peh, nevertheless, their children and their grandchildren are not fully considered heretics. Accordingly, there's no mitzvah to kill them initially. We should try to be makariv them and the like. Now, the Rambam here tells us that even though we have someone that's denying one of the Ikari Emuna, nevertheless, we clearly don't apply the principle of Nabuchanapikaris is Achatanapikaris. They're not deemed a heretic in the full sense. So it would seem that, at the very least, with respect to some Ikari Emuna, we don't apply Reb Chaim's principle. Which brings us to the second approach, which we considered last time, and that is, well, maybe the idea of Nebuchadnezzar is only said with respect to certain Ikari Emuna, specifically with respect to the Ikari Emuna that relate to a proper conception of God. So, perhaps when it comes to the first five of the Ikari Emuna, namely God's existence, His unity, His non-corporeality, His eternity, and the imperative to worship God exclusively, so then we would say Nebuchadnezzar, like we said before, the person who has the incorrect conception of God loses Olam Haba by definition. It's impossible. When it comes to the latter eight Ikari Emuna, so that is not so. These things are important to know. They're certainly necessary to believe in. But if someone errs with respect to these beliefs, so Olam Haba, eternity, is not by definitionally impossible. For example, with this we could explain or respond to the claim made by the Radvaz. The Radvaz notes that Hillel Sheni did not believe in a personal Mashiach. He is one of the Amoraim in the Gemara. Now, that means that one of the Amoraim did not believe in one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna. If we were to apply the standard of Nebuchadnezzar to all 13 principles, that would mean that he's a heretic, and he has no chelek in Olam Haba, and there's a mitzvah to hate him, and so on and so forth. Now, it would seem strange then that he would be included in the Gemara. He's the author of our calendar, among other things. And therefore, if we distinguish between Ikari Emuna, the question is resolved. Hillel Sheni did not make a theological error with respect to his conception of God. He made an error concerning Mashiach. He thought that the psukim describing Mashiach indicated that the psukim that described the personal Mashiach referring to someone that had already lived and died, and he made a mistake. True, it was a big mistake, but we don't fault him for his mistake. After all, he came to his mistake from a misunderstanding of the sources, and moreover, at that time, apparently it wasn't universally accepted or clear that there was that there will be a personal Mashiach. The matter was still somewhat contested, it would seem, and therefore, we don't apply the principle of Nebuchadnezzar for these types of beliefs. And again, it's very straightforward. Why should it be that an incorrect understanding of Mashiach should necessarily and automatically lead to a loss of Olam Haba? One should theoretically be able to get Olam Haba, even though they have an incorrect understanding of Mashiach or Tchias HaMesim or the like. But when it comes to something like the correct conception of God, that would not be the case. That was the second approach that we suggested last year. So therefore, with respect to the final eight principles, we would apply the principle of Tinok Shenishba, and therefore, the second generation Karaite does indeed reject one of the principles of Emunah, but it's not one of the first five. It doesn't relate to God. It, in fact, relates to Torah, and therefore, since his mistake, his error, is accidental, so he would not be excluded from Klal Yisrael. We would not say about him, Nebuchadnezzar. The problems with this theory are, first of all, the actual case of Tinok Shenishba, namely someone who is taken captive by idolaters and raised by idolaters, presumably is someone who does have a misconception, an incorrect conception of God. So the case in Shas doesn't seem to correspond to this example. Not a pircha, but certainly a ha'ara. Another problem we considered was that the palace analogy in section 3, chapter 51 of the guide seemed to apply the principle of Tinok Shenishba even to someone who believed in a corporeal god. Number three, even if we're going to say that with respect to the first five principles we don't apply Tinok Shenishba, so why is it that we have to hate such a person? Meaning to say as follows. The Rambam writes that there are two applications to the principle of, or to two halachic and, not halachic, two applications to heresy. One is that there's no, he has no chelek in Olam Haba. Number two is, as we saw, that there's a mitzvah to hate him, to kill him, and so on and so forth. Now, we noted last time that the obligation to kill a heretic does not apply anymore for a number of reasons. Anyhow, but the point is that I could understand why, with respect to the first five principles, we would say Nebuch an Apikores, because after all, like we said, by definition, Olam Haba is impossible for such a person. But why would the second application of heresy apply? When someone comes to a false belief concerning, let's say, God's corporeality, so assuming that it's not his fault, that he was misled by the Psukim or the Midrashim, so why should we hate him? On the contrary, just like we say with respect to the Tinok Shenishba, that it's a mitzvah lakarvo, and we're not dolchko, so too with respect to someone who believes in a corporeal conception of God, there should be a mitzvah lekarvo. Why is it that we would apply Nebuch an Apikores even to the first five principles, at least with respect to the application of that the heretic is excluded from Klal Yisrael? So this brings us to today's shiur, and the third approach to understanding how the Rambam would deal with someone who comes to a false belief based off of a misunderstanding of the Torah. But before we start,
isn't the example of Obed Avodah Zarah who was Tinok Shenishba, isn't that one of the first five?
Yes, that's the point. I agree. That's the problem. That was the first problem we said for the second approach. That the case of Tinok Shenishba is presumably someone who's Obed Avodah Zarah, and that would contradict one of the first five. Well, the case in the Rambam, I mean, you mean when he talks about in Shkagos. Yeah, so that's just applying the Gemara. In other words, there's two cases of Tinok Shenishba. One is the case that the Gemara actually says it, and that's said with respect to Karban Chatas. And then the second one is Rambam's expansion of the principle to the second generation Karaite, and that's said with respect to the obligation to shun him and exclude him and the like. Now, the reason why he said it's not a pircha is you could conceivably distinguish and say that Rambam's expansion of Tinok Shenishba is not the same thing. The Gemara is referring to someone who's an Oved Avodah Zarah, and he would be considered Shogeg L'Inyan Shabbos, and for purposes of Karbanos, a Chatas would be appropriate. And that's one standard. And that's not to say he's not a heretic. All that means to say is, since he's Shavim Yediyaso and the like, he brings a single carbon for all of his Shabbos violations. And then the second type of application of Tinok Shenishba is the Rambam's novel understanding, which is said in a totally different context and has different parameters. So it's not a pircha, but if we wanted to assume that the two principles are more closely related to each other, then it indeed would present a problem for the second approach. Okay. So, the third approach. One other ha'ara, another issue we noted for the first two approaches is the Rambam's Mahalich in 146, where he says that the Torah itself does in fact use these references, these corporeal references to God, because the people at the time could not, at least initially, be taught that God existed in a non-corporeal form. They couldn't relate to such a thing, and they therefore had to be first taught that God exists, and to do so, it was necessary to imply, at the very least, that he had a body, and then that is why the Torah uses these terms that are so easily misunderstood. Now, that being the case, we suggested that that is problematic for the first two approaches. If you say that by definition a person is a heretic if they accept a corporeal understanding of God, then to basically write the Torah in a way that actually indicates that God is corporeal is especially problematic. Again, there too we said why it might not be a pircha, but it certainly is a ha'ara. The third approach is the following. The third approach basically says that we have to distinguish between the two applications that the Rambam gives concerning the heretic. As we noted before, the Rambam says at the end of his Hakdama to Perek Chelek, and this was the first source we saw in our packets on this topic, that there are two applications. Application number one is that he has no chelek in Olam Haba. Application number two is that it's a mitzvah to hate him and to exclude him. Now, perhaps we would say the following. Perhaps we would say that it's clear this passage cannot be referring to Tinok Shenishba. Why? Because this passage states explicitly that someone who denies the validity of Tarsha Baal Peh, there's a mitzvah to hate him. Now, we know that that's not true if it's accidental from the Rambam's Tinok Shenishba principle. And therefore, this passage cannot be talking about accidental heresy. It must be talking about intentional heresy. So, perhaps we would say that when it comes to accidental heresy, we would still say that they have no chelek in Olam Haba. About that, Reb Chaim was certainly correct. Nebuchadnezzar is achat nabikores. Why? Because of what we said concerning the first approach, that the lack of Olam Haba is a natural consequence of a faulty conception of God. Olam Haba is by definition impossible under those circumstances. So, when it comes to Olam Haba, we say Nebuchadnezzar is achat nabikores. But when it comes to exclusion from Klal Yisrael, so then we say that a person is only excluded if they intentionally are heretics. We'll have to define that a little later. But only if they're intentionally heretics, but someone who's ones, someone who denies a principle because they were educated improperly or because they misunderstood the psukim or chazal, so then we would say, of course, it's not a mitzvah to hate them. The opposite, mitzvah lekarvan, we should teach them that is correct, bring them close to us, return them to the faith, and the like. So the third approach is very simple. The third approach says that we apply Nebuchadnezzar when it comes to Olam Haba, because loss of Olam Haba is a natural consequence, but when it comes to the application of exclusion from Klal Yisrael, so then quite the contrary. Anyone who is unintentionally a heretic should be loved and brought close to correct and true beliefs. And that would resolve the problem of Tinok Shenishba. Why? Because when the Rambam tells us the principle of Tinok Shenishba and Hochos Mamrim, what's he talking about? He's not talking about Olam Haba. He doesn't say the second, third generation Karaites have Olam Haba. What does he say? He said they're not meant to be excluded from Klal Yisrael, mitzvah lekarvan. So therefore, we might conclude that when it comes to someone who is a heretic due to faulty beliefs or misunderstanding of the sources or bad education, so then with respect to the application of exclusion, we apply Tinok Shenishba and we welcome them. And with respect to the application of Olam Haba, so then we would say Nebuchadnezzar. And this would seem to fit nicely with the Rambam's presentation in Hilchos Tshuva. As I mentioned before, in Hilchos Tshuva Per Gimel, the Rambam also presents these 13 beliefs, or at least 12 out of the 13 explicitly. And there the Rambam says anyone who lacks these beliefs lacks Olam Haba. He doesn't write that they're excluded from Klal Yisrael. In fact, he writes afal pi sheyisrael heim. So, therefore, we would suggest that in Hilchos Tshuva, where he's talking about Olam Haba, so there we would say that Nebuchadnezzar, if you have false beliefs, so then you have no Olam Haba. But when he discusses in Hilchos Mamrim the principle of Tinok Shenishba, so then what's he talking about? He's talking about exclusion or exclusion, inclusion or exclusion. And there he distinguishes between the first and second generation Karaites. And there might be, if you look in your source sheets, a small one way to read his Perusha Mishnayis in Chulin on page 30, we won't read it together, might support this as well. Okay. Now, is this approach so simple? So this approach also isn't so simple, though I think it is stronger than the previous two approaches. For one thing, because if you look in Hilchos Shechita, Perek Dalid, Halacha Yud Dalid, which is on page 31 of your source sheets, you might be medayik that the Rambam, well, let's read it together. Im hayu mishumad lavodizara o mechal o shabbos befarhesia o min fu akofer betoro v'moshe rabbeinu k'moshe biyarnu b'holchos tshuva hareyu k'goy v'shchitasu nevela. The halacha is, of course, that the shchita of a goy is invalid, and the Rambam here writes that the same thing is true with respect to a kofer. And how does he define a kofer? K'moshe biyarnu b'holchos tshuva, where the Rambam told you what a kofer is. And then he writes a little later, Elu hatzedukim v'abay susim v'talmideim v'chol atoim achareim she'enem ma'amina b'torah she'bal peh shchitasim k'sheira v'mshachto b'faneinu harezim v'ter she'en iser shchitasim ela shema yikalkalo. However, the Rambam continues, when it comes to the Tinok Shenishba, so then a shchita is kasher. So it sounds like he might be saying that when it comes to that Hilchos Tshuva is talking about someone who's not a Tinok Shenishba. Because again, he writes, those that are heretics, as we explained in Hilchos Tshuva, their Shechita is automatically invalid. But those who are Tinok Shenishba, their Shechita is not necessarily invalid. Now the implication is that the someone who's a Tinok Shenishba is not someone who's discussed in Hilchos Tshuva, which would imply that the only source that we know that someone who is an accidental heretic has no Olam Haba, the only source for that was Hilchos Tshuva, and Hilchos Tshuva isn't actually talking about an accidental heretic. It's talking about an intentional heretic. To put it a little differently, there's no source that serves to tell us that someone who is Nebuchadnezzar has no Chelek in Olam Haba. Like we said, Hakdamat Perek Chelek is definitely not talking about the accidental heretic. It's definitely not talking about the Tinok Shenishba. And even Hilchos Tshuva, based off of this diuk in Hilchos Shechita, is not talking about the accidental heretic, in which case there is no makor that the accidental heretic has no Olam Haba. And once there's no makor in the Rambam, then maybe it's not true. Further support for this could be brought from Hilchos Eidos, again on page 31. The Rambam in Hilchos Eidos here asks the question, why is it that heretics are not listed among those in the Mishnayos and Gemaras and Sanhedrin as those who are invalid as a witness? The Rambam writes there, Hamosrim v'apikorsim haminim v'mishumadim lo hotzrichu chachamim limnos o son bichlal psulei ha'edos shelomanu ela rishei Yisrael. Aval elu hamoridim hakofrim pchusim in agayim shagayim lo malin v'lo moridin v'yesh lechasidehen chelek l'olam haba v'elu moridin v'lo malin v'ein lam chelek l'olam haba. The Rambam says the Gemara didn't have to tell us that a heretic is invalid as a witness, because the Gemara told us that a non-Jew is invalid as a witness, and a heretic is a lot worse than a guy. After all, a guy may have chelek in olam haba and a heretic doesn't. A guy, there's no mitzvah to kill him. A heretic, there is. So therefore, if goyim are excluded, so certainly heretics are excluded. Now, we know that a tinok shenishba is not invalid as a witness, according to the Rambam. He writes that in Avadim Vavav. So if that's the case, so we might deduce that they have a chelek in Olam Haba. It's only the kofrim b'mezid about which the Rambam says they have no chelek in Olam Haba, but not necessarily the tinok shenishba. Which brings us to the fourth approach. The fourth approach is certainly the most, I'd say, the approach that I think we're most comfortable with. Meaning to say that, at least for many of us, for me, say, the first three approaches, which assumed that a person who misunderstands the Torah is automatically excluded, or someone with an incorrect conception of God is automatically excluded, is very troubling. It's difficult to understand, it's difficult to swallow. While it might work nicely with Rambam's understanding of what the soul is and what Olam Haba is, it doesn't sit well. And perhaps even the Rambam would not say that someone who is truly innocent but has a false conception of God is excluded either from Olam Haba or from Klal Yisrael, at least by definition. And proof for this actually comes from the Mor Nevuchim, among other places. If you take a look, go back to page 26 in your source sheets, the guide, Chelek Aleph, Perek Lamed Vav. So the Rambam here actually deals with the Ravid's Kasha. Remember, the Ravid said, why should it be that someone who has a faulty understanding of God based off of the Psukim should be excluded? Right? After all, it's not his fault. He came to his conclusion based off of his misunderstanding of Torah sources. So that was the Ravid's challenge, and the Rambam actually addresses this challenge over here in Mor Nevuchim. We'll read it in English. If you think that there is an excuse for those who believe in the corporeality of God on the ground of their training, their ignorance, or their defective comprehension, you must make the same concession to the worshippers of idols. Their worship is due to ignorance or early training. They continue in the custom of their fathers. Says the Rambam, if you're going to say that someone, let's say, who denies divine corporeality because he was educated by Uncle Maishi, who says Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is everywhere, and he concludes that God must have a body. So if you're going to exonerate him for his faulty beliefs based off of his misunderstanding, his bad education, so we should also exonerate the idolater. After all, how do most idolaters become idolaters? Because their parents told them to be idolaters. Parenthetically, relating to this week's parsha, Parsha Shlach Lecha, the Rambam writes concerning Avram's youth that he too was an idolater. If you look at the Rambam at the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, when he describes the evolution of idolatry, the Rambam writes that Avram was born in a society that was polytheistic, and then he writes, Vihu haya oved imahem. He too was an Oved Avodah Zarah, at least initially. From a young age, he began questioning and wondering, and as he grew older, he came to the conclusion that God definitively exists and rejected those idolatrous claims. But as a child, hu haya oved imahem, he used to go to church also. We say in the Haggadah, mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu. So that's generally understood as referring to the parents of Avram. But avoseinu, according to the Rambam, might mean Avraham. Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu, that Avram was also an idolater. Hu haya oved imahem. So, if the Rambam writes we're going to exonerate the person who believes that God is a body because of his faulty education, we should also exonerate the idolater. You will perhaps say, the Rambam continues, that the literal interpretation of the Bible causes men to fall into that doubt. But you must know that idolaters were likewise brought to their beliefs by false imaginations and ideas. Meaning to say, no, we don't exonerate a person who comes to faulty conclusions due to false imaginations and ideas. And that is because a human being is capable of coming to the correct conclusions with respect to the existence of God and also with respect to his non-corporeality. There is no excuse whatever for those who, being unable to think for themselves, do not accept the doctrine of the incorporeality of God from the true philosophers. Now, if you're going to say, the Rambam writes, that, well, not everybody is a philosopher. So it's true that the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim offers proof that God does not have a body, as well as in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, but not everybody is capable of independently discovering that proof. So therefore, once again, we shouldn't hold them accountable. It's not their fault. They're not philosophers. The Rambam writes, no, that's not an excuse. Why? Because they should have accepted the belief from the true philosophers. Meaning to say that there have been plenty of people that have been teaching that God does not have a body. I do not consider those men as infidels who are unable to prove the incorporeality, but I hold those to be so who do not believe in it, especially when they see that Targum Onkelos and Targum Yonah's son avoid, in reference to God, expressions implying corporeality as much as possible. Meaning to say, the Rambam is basically answering the Ravid's critique by saying it is their fault. It is their fault. They should have known better. We don't excuse someone from faulty beliefs when they're capable of coming to true beliefs. It's true the Rambam says we don't expect everybody to be a philosopher, but the halacha is everybody has to learn Shnai Mikra. And if you learn Shnai Mikra, you will clearly see that God doesn't have a body. Because time and time again, Targum Onkelos translates the psukim in ways that clearly deny corporeality. Just as an example, when the pasuk says Vayered Hashem in Shmos Perek Yotes, the Targum translates it as Vizgale Hashem, so as to prevent the error that might arise from the simple reading of the text. Now, there is famously a debate between the Rambam and the Ramban what the primary motivation of Onkelos is. Is he trying primarily to exclude corporeality, or is he also alluding to mystical secrets, as the Ramban suggests? But nevertheless, everybody would agree that he does succeed, for the most part, in removing corporeality from the text of the Chumash. So the Rambam is basically saying that if you do what you're supposed to do, if you learn Shnai Mikra, you won't come to this false belief. And therefore, someone who does come to the false belief, well, they're not exonerated due to innocence, because in fact, they are not innocent. That's what the Rambam seems to be saying. Now, if you accept the first three approaches to Nebuchadnezzar that we have been suggesting until now, the Rambam is not answering the question correctly. The reason why someone is excluded from Olam Haba according to the first three approaches, if he has a false conception of God, is not because it's his fault. It's because, by definition, Olam Haba is impossible for someone with a faulty conception of God. So the Rambam gave the wrong answer. To this question, the Rambam should have said, Nebuchadnezzar. The Rambam should have said, it's true it's not his fault, but, at the same time, Olam Haba is by definition impossible. Now again, this isn't muchrach, because you could say that's true, but this is also true, and this answer makes you feel a little better. But still, the simple reading of Mor Nevuchim is, surprisingly enough, supportive of the frumer reading of the Rambam, as opposed to the Mishneh Torah, and against against the Nabuchodonosor approach. Now, this would also work very nicely with the passage that we saw last time that explained that the Torah and all of the Nevi'im depict God in physical terms so as to bring people to belief, because people, at least in the ancient world, were incapable of coming to initially to belief in an incorporeal God. Steeped in a world of idolatry and polytheism, had they been told initially that God exists but has no body, they would not be able to come to such belief. And therefore the Torah speaks in a way that could allow them to conclude that God does have a body. Now, that would fit very nicely with this theory, especially if you suggest, and you don't have to say this, that perhaps there was some type of development over time. Meaning to say that, remember, the Rambam writes, how is it that the reason, why is it that people are responsible to know that God doesn't have a body? He said, because the true philosophers taught that. Well, who exactly are the true philosophers? I don't know. Not sure who he's referring to, but one could suggest that with time, it became more and more clear that God does not have a body. There was no longer a need to present God in corporeal terms to bring people to belief. When, as the opinions of true philosophers proliferated, and when tools like Unculus became readily available and mandated, so then it became the case that the excuse went away. So essentially what we're suggesting is that if a person is truly innocent, then we would always apply something along the lines of Tinok Shenishba. The Rambam nowhere states that someone who is truly innocent is excluded from either the Jewish people or Olam Haba. However, the Rambam has relatively high standards with respect to innocence. And the Rambam maintains that at least with respect to things like belief in God's corporeality, at least in his time, it was the case that no one had any excuses. Whereas, when it comes to other beliefs, like denial of Tarshish Baal Peh, so then the Rambam writes that sometimes people will have an excuse, like the case of the Karaites. So essentially, on each and every one of the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna, the Rambam would say, let's think about, is there a plausible excuse for this person or group of people, or is there not a plausible excuse? If there's a plausible excuse, so then we would apply the principle of Tinok Shenishba, and if there is not a plausible excuse, so then we would say they're responsible for their beliefs, and therefore they're deemed a heretic.
Why is that Nebuch?
That's not Nebuch, that's the point. Okay, the Rambam didn't use the word Nebuch. I'm not, right, so. So this approach is saying that you are responsible for your own beliefs, and therefore, if you come to faulty beliefs in a way that you could have avoided them, even though you might, then you are held accountable, and so we'll take out the word Nebuch. You are an apikores in the full with all of its applications. Whereas when it is not your fault, then you're not. And the Rambam happens to write that no one has an excuse with respect to something like corporeality, especially in light of tools like Targum Unculus. Probably the Reb Chaim didn't write this, his theory, so we could only guess. But we'll see in a moment. Reb Elchanan's understanding of Reb Chaim is very much compatible with this theory. So it's not the way Reb Chaim is generally understood, but it's the way it's compatible with Reb Elchanan's understanding of Reb Chaim. And I don't know what Reb Chaim actually said, but it's definitely against the way the Velt says Reb Chaim. I'll take your question one more. Just two more points concerning this. One troubling element of this thesis is that a person who believes in a corporal God is not intentionally distorting the truth, presumably. And therefore, why is he held accountable? In other words, even though we might say that he could have known better, but still, and this might be part of Ravid's objection, it's not like he's malicious, it would seem. So why is he being treated so harshly? So it seems to me that the Rambam maintains that theological errors that could have been avoided do in fact reflect subconscious wickedness. The Rambam, this doesn't necessarily mean we treat them as a full-fledged mazid, right? For example, we know there is such a thing as Avodah Zarah B'Shogeg, but nevertheless, they at the very least reflect subconscious wickedness. And you see this whenever you see the Rambam discuss certain types of mistakes. For example, in Hilchos Tshuva, Gimel Hay, he writes, "Vaminim heim hatarim achar machshavos libam besichlos." And in fact, Chazal already make this point. "Velo sasuru acharei levavchem," Chazal tell us, is referring to minus. So, minus, heresy, comes from being tar acharei halev. Just like acharei einechem, we understand that a person can come to do certain types of averos by looking at certain types of things. So if a person allows themselves, the Rambam writes, to think in a certain type of way, so then they will come to heresy. And this is something that could be avoided. Another example, the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim, when he describes the first generation of Karaites, he writes that those who follow the frivolous thought, he who follows his frivolous thoughts and his capricious heart and denies the oral Torah on his own, as did Tzadok and Vaisos v'chulei. Now, the mistakes of the Karaites, the first generation Karaites of Tzadok and Vaisos, so they come from following frivolous thoughts and the like. So while on the one hand it does seem to be the case that it's not very malicious if you believe in God to believe in a corporeal God, at the same time the Rambam writes that if a person is in fact capable of coming to the truth and they don't do so, they allow themselves to be led astray by their own heart, so that in fact reflects subconscious wickedness. The Rambam also in Mor Nevuchim, Per Gimel, Mem Aleph, writes that there are four classes of averos: involuntary, ignorance, mazed, knowingly, and then those done spitefully. That's the fourth. And he puts Avodah Zarah in the fourth category. Now, again, one might have said, Avodah Zarah, why should that necessarily be considered something done spitefully? After all, they made a mistake. Instead of thinking there's one God, they thought there are three. The Rambam says no. The Rambam writes that such an error reflects spite. Maybe not conscious spite, meaning to say a person doesn't necessarily wake up in the morning and say, I want to be spiteful to God, but the Rambam is telling us that our beliefs are largely in our hands, in the sense that a person, for various motivations, might allow themselves to come to false beliefs. L'mashal, in this week's Parsha, Rashi, last week concerning Nimrod, writes that he was Yodea Boro Umiskavim Limrod Bo. So, what does that mean exactly? The simple understanding is, Hitaka knew that God existed, and he said, but I'm going to rebel against you. Now, that doesn't make too much sense, because if you know that God exists, then it doesn't make sense to rebel. So, it might mean something more along the lines of what the Rambam is saying here. To put it a little differently, as I mentioned just a minute ago, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, we'll read it in a couple minutes, also has a very similar theory to the Rambam, very similar to the one that I'm presenting. And Rabbi Elchanan writes the following. He takes this idea a little further. He writes, that it's very strange that there would be a mitzvah of emuna on multiple levels. First of all, it would seem that belief in God is something that is not so simple. After all, someone as brilliant as Aristotle made major errors with respect to matters of faith. Now, if it is the case that it's simple, then how could someone so brilliant err? On the other hand, Rebbe Ochanan notes that every single Jew, every boy and girl of the age of 12 and 13 is commanded in a mitzvah of emunah. Now, how could that be? If it's something that Aristotle failed in, how could this be expected of someone who's a little kid? And Rebbe Ochanan's approach, and in a moment we'll raise some questions with this, but Rebbe Ochanan's approach is very similar to what I think emerges from the Rambam, which is that every person, if they search honestly, will in fact come to the correct conclusion that God exists. After all, the way Rebbe Ochanan presents it is, how could anything exist without there being a creator? So if there is existence, then there must be a creator. Next week we'll talk about whether that type of argument still holds water in contemporary world, but for now we'll accept it. So anyone who thinks about it honestly will indeed come to the conclusion that God exists. So why is it then that people don't come to that conclusion? It's because they're not thinking honestly. Well, why aren't they thinking honestly? Because we all have all sorts of subconscious motivations and inclinations. Rebbe Ochanan understands this as shochad. Because there's a motivation to deny God, among other things, that allows you to seek pleasures in a way that you would wish. So these motivations, this shochad affects the way you think. And it could cause you to come to false beliefs. But ultimately, a person has the capability of coming to the truth, of not being affected by this shochad. And therefore, if you don't, you're held responsible. It's true Aristotle had false beliefs. But why did he come to those beliefs? Not because of an honest error, but because of shochad. The more brilliant you are, the more brilliant your shochad will be. But every person, at whatever level they exist, will come to the truth, at least with respect to God's existence, Rebbe Ochanan claims, if they search honestly.
Whose term is shochad?
I'm sorry?
The term shochad you're using, whose term is that?
Rebbe Ochanan applies that principle to here. Yes, he uses the term.
Is he using it based on someone else's term?
I don't remember if anyone uses it before. I think Rabbi Saul Salanter uses it as well in that type of context. Maybe even before that. Now, that's essentially what the Rambam indicates. And we see this with respect to Avodah Zarah, at the very least in Chazal as well. The Gemara says that the motivation for idolatry was Lahatir Arayos. What does that mean? Presumably it doesn't mean that they said, oh, I know God exists, but I want to engage in certain pleasures, so I'm going to serve idolatry. It means subconsciously their desire for pleasure led them to think in a way that brought about belief in idolatry.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Mm-hmm.
Quite frequently here, mm-hmm. and maybe you can just address this because I haven't really thought about this. You use the terms of conscious wickedness, which I don't really understand. You're talking about subconscious again. The general rule will say that the world that mankind didn't really understand was subconscious until Freud came along. So I don't. Maybe Jewish Hoshkafa precedes that. So I wonder if you could address that, but because.
Okay, it does. I think when you look.
I don't know.
Right. So the term subconscious is certainly not a term that they use, though we do find things like negios and the like, that term used, which I think, and again, when you read the Rambam, that's I don't understand, I don't know of any other way how to read what the Rambam's saying. In other words, what the Rambam, and again, what, let's take Chazal say, when they say that people came to polytheistic belief, came to Avodah Zarah, lahatir arayos. So basically, again, I don't think that was conscious. It doesn't make any sense that it's conscious. Because if you believe in God, so then you're not consciously going to reject God to do, let's say it this way. The people that served idolatry really believed in what they were doing, right? They were moser nefesh for it. That very same Gemara describes this little kid, right, who on his dying breath pulls out his molech. So when it says that they served idolatry, lahati arayos, but they really believed in idolatry. It was true belief. So if it was true belief, then it wasn't lahati arayos. It was because they believed in it. I don't understand. Which one was it? If it was just lahati arayos, they didn't really believe in it. So the only way that I could understand that is again, maybe we shouldn't use the word subconscious, that's anachronistic, but nevertheless, the only way I could understand that is that, in fact, this was not, they weren't aware of this calculation. This was something that was happening without their awareness, but they're held responsible because they could have done otherwise. And that's what I think Chazal say when they interpret the lo sasuru achare levavchem as referring to minus. Now,
look. Sounds just like that. I don't say why is it so hard to understand conscious self-deception. People do it all the time. People on a conscious level, not on a subconscious,
they know that they're doing what they're doing is false.
People do wrong. How do they do it? Because it's shekher. They're self-deceiving. People do it every day.
But that's what self-deceiving is. I mean, that's
conscious, not subconscious.
So
it's not on the subconscious level. It's on the conscious level. It's not semantics. It's an important distinction.
Okay, I hear your claim. I guess I'd like to think about it a little more. But that's not the way I would look at it. I would look at it. But something to think about. Just we're almost out of time. Just want a couple of Maramar Makomos. Is there anyone who understood the Rambam the way I'm suggesting? So one of the first to present the Rambam along these lines is a Rishon, Rav Meir of Narbon, sometimes known as Hama'ili. He lived from 1190 to 1263. Among other things, he was the author of Sefer HaMe'oros, which is on Hilchos Brachos, Chulin, and Moed. He was from Spain. He died in Toledo. And he writes in a work called Ma'amar Meshiv Nefesh that it's impossible that the Rambam would maintain that someone who understood the various chazals that imply that God has a body would be deemed a heretic. First of all, he writes that if this were the case, then that would make most of our nation a heretic. And would the Rambam really think that we should kill most Jewish people? No. Certainly the Rambam would agree that someone who killed such a person would be a murderer. The Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah Perek Beis writes that these matters are difficult to understand, and therefore he claims that the Rambam only means to say that someone who rejects tradition and comes to their own conclusions is deemed a heretic. Not exactly what we said, but along similar lines. As we noted as well, Rabbi Chanan also has a similar approach to the Rambam. You could see this on page 32, probably, of your Makoros. Yeah, 32, the top of page 32. And again, he claims that this is even the view of Rabbi Chaim. The Chazon Ish, also at the bottom of page 32, doesn't seem to understand Reb Chaim, at least in the traditional sense, like Reb Chaim in the traditional sense. He also applies the principle of Tinok Shenishba to all categories, It's this Chazon Ish that many poskim utilize to deem most non-observant Jews nowadays as Tinok Shenishba, even though they certainly reject many of the Ikari Emunah, even those concerning the nature of God. There were those before him, the first to sort of apply this principle. He actually had three theories, was the Arach Lener. We don't have time to get into it. There is an issue that people raise concerning the applicability of Rabbi Elchanan's approach nowadays. Rav Amital, in his book, Jewish Values in a Changing World, writes, "I believe that Rabbi Wasserman's explanations do not suffice. Many people come to a secular outlook not in order to satisfy their desires, but rather because of their dedication to ideals that may, at times, even demand great sacrifice. It is difficult to pin all disbelief on following one's desires." What would Rabbi Elchanan say to that? It's an interesting question. Might he say things are different nowadays? Probably not, because he deduces his principle based off of the eternal mitzvah of Emunah. Nevertheless, one might consider the following. Rabbi Elchanan's theory, even if we accept it, only makes sense with respect to belief in God. We could argue that anyone who honestly thinks about the matter might come to belief in God. But it certainly is not the case that they're going to come to belief in Tchias HaMesim. So how does Rabbi Elchanan apply his principle to other Ikari Emunah? And the answer basically is, Rabbi Elchanan says, well, belief in God will also lead to belief in Torah, which will lead to belief in other Ikari Emunah. But at the same time, Rabbi Elchanan acknowledges that this isn't true for all principles of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah. After all, the Rambam says that the Tinok Shenishba is not a full-fledged heretic. So essentially what Rabbi Elchanan says is that with respect to some beliefs, we will apply Tinok Shenishba, and with respect to others, we won't. In the Rambam's time, it might have been the case that the only one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah for which we would apply Tinok Shenishba was with respect to the truth of Torah Shebaal Peh, and that's because it was only the Karaites that came to that conclusion, and everybody else were from Jews. But perhaps nowadays, we would expand the Ikari Emunah about which we say Tinok Shenishba beyond just that particular example of the validity of Torah Shebaal Peh. I'm just going to briefly give you some other Mamre Chomos because we're about out of time, but just so you know where to look if you'd like some further, to look into things further. If you look in on page, let's see here, 33, you'll see the Radvaz, who explicitly, whether or not the Rambam, the correct interpretation of the Rambam is Reb Chaim or not, there were those who explicitly disagreed with this view, meaning to say they explicitly maintained that when false beliefs, even with respect to God, such as corporeality, came from a faulty understanding of the sources, so then we do not deem such a person a full-fledged heretic. We saw earlier that the Ravid maintains this. This is also the view of the Radvaz. He was discussing a preacher who publicly taught that Moshe was divine in some sense. And the Radvaz says that we're not going to treat him as a kofar, just like Chazal clearly don't treat Hillel Sheni as a kofar, despite denying one of the Ikari Emunah. The Sefer Ikarim later on comes to a similar conclusion. Again, it's important to note that the Sefer Ikarim does not write that he's fully innocent, but he also doesn't write that he's mazed. He says he's Chote Bishogeg. There's a nice piece from Rav Kook. Rav Kook here is defending Rav Moshe Glasner, who was attacked due to his beliefs in Zionism. And Rav Kook writes in a letter to those who were defaming him that, look, you might think that his views are incorrect, but we accept the view of the Ikarim and the Radvaz, and even if you think his views are wrong, but it's no worse than someone who comes to a false belief about God. Just like over there, we say that he's wrong, but at the same time, we understand, we don't attack him or attack his character, because a person could come to major errors innocently, so too, why are you attacking this fellow even though you think he's totally wrong? Another discussion which I was hoping to get to today, but we don't have time, so I'll just mention it. Who exactly was the Ravid referring to when he said that there were great people, people even greater than the Rambam, who believed in a corporeal God? So even if we add some salt to that statement and we assume that it was somewhat of an exaggeration, but clearly the Ravid, and you see this among other thinkers, that assumed that there were great Talmidei Chachamim who believed in a corporeal God. So who was that? If you look in Dr. Mark Shapiro's book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, he lists a number of Torah scholars who purportedly subscribe to corporealism. If you look at his examples carefully, many of them, at least I believe, are hasty conclusions that are not so convincing. For example, he includes Rashi on that list, and one of his proofs that he brings is Rashi's famous comment in Shmos, where he says Yad Mamish. But as many have pointed out, Yad Mamish, he says this about other things. It doesn't mean literally a hand. It doesn't mean God swept down with his hand and took him out of Egypt. There are a number of Rashi's, I think one of the best is in Bereishis, that indicate that Rashi was not a corporealist. He writes things that sound corporeal, so do Chazal. Rashi didn't necessarily understand that those are literal. There was an interesting back and forth about this in the Hakira Torah Journal over a number of issues. Shaul Zucker claimed that if you look through all of Shapiro's lists, the only three examples of known identifiable corporealists among Torah scholars are Rav Moshe Taku, Rav Shlomo Simcha of Troyes, and Rav Avram ben Azriel Shapiro. Meaning to say, not necessarily the most well-known Torah scholars. So as I said, there is an interesting discussion, especially within Rashi, though my personal belief is that a very strong case can be made that Rashi did not believe in a corporeal God, though there have been people who have made arguments on both sides. So with that, we'll stop, since I am out of time, and I'll take your question, but feel free to get ready for next class. Again? I didn't hear again?
Is it possible that maybe Rabbi Nachman is talking about someone who thought he believed in a corporeal God, but he didn't?
It's possible, yeah. Most of the cases where you see people yelling about corporealists are among those that are yelling. So Rabbi Kanefogel, Dr. Kanefogel, in his argument points out that you can't always prove it from those types of sources, because whenever you're in a polemic against how bad a certain thing is, the tendency might be to exaggerate its prominence. Yeah. It's a fair point.